Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
You know, this is not the quickest cooking method. So this is more of a, you know, day around the fireplace that you're cracking walnuts and chatting and eating cheeses, and the ducks slowly cook on the over the fire.
We're with Daniel Orr at a friend's house in Columbus, Indiana, where he's preparing a fireplace feast. Harvest Public Media today asks why a government system designed to help get payments out to farmers hasn't lived up to expectations. We then go inside the rundown structures immigrant farm workers call home during the harvest season. Welsh rarebit is our snack in the second half today. Think of it like gourmet cheese whiz. And a spirits lesson with whiskey aficionado Brad Dunn. Food stories in the news from the past couple weeks. Mark Chilla.
The first genetically engineered animal has been approved by the FDA for human consumption in the U.S. After years of debate, the genetically engineered salmon developed by Aqua Bounty Technologies is cleared for market. How long it will actually take to get to supermarkets is another story. The genetically engineered salmon is created by combining genes from two edible fish to create a salmon that grows faster and with 25% less feed. Aqua Bounty has said it might take years to grow enough salmon for market. Then there is the issue of how to label it. As it stands currently, the United States does not require genetically engineered crops to be labeled. Aqua Bounty is pushing to simply label the salmon as Atlantic salmon, though it's likely to meet debate. A Gallup poll this summer showed that the number of Americans struggling to afford food is at a 7-year low. The most recent government data from 2014 shows that nearly 50 million people are food insecure, including more than 15 million children. That year, 1 in 4 food insecure households got emergency food from a food pantry. Congress is conducting hearings on the SNAP program, with a much-anticipated report due soon from the National Commission on Hunger. Obesity rates in the U.S. continue to climb. As Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data released this month show, the rate of obesity in adults has topped 36%, and in young people, it's 17%. Rates have been steadily rising starting back in 2005. The CDC report didn't attempt to uncover the reasons why obesity continues to climb, but another recent study at Cornell University did. Professors Brian Wansink and David Just studied fast food consumption and compared it to body mass index. Using data from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, they found that the frequency of consumption of candy, soda, and fast food had no correlation on BMI. Instead, they concluded that increased calorie consumption was more to blame for Americans' growing waistlines. Wansink and Just argue that cutting out junk food altogether is not the answer, but instead enjoying it, like anything else, in moderation. Some Midwest crop farmers are receiving their first government payments under the new Farm Bill enacted last year. As Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, taxpayers are spending more than projected.
With the new Farm Bill, farmers choose a safety net program, one based on average yield or on crop prices. Lawmakers hoped the new programs would save money, but University of Illinois economist Gary Schnittke says the program's actually costing more this year than the system it replaced.
This year is going to be higher. It's going to be over $6 billion. And as we move through time, those payments likely will come down in future years.
So Schnittke says the billions of dollars in savings projected when the law was passed last year could still be achieved over its 5-year lifespan. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Find out more about news stories like these as soon as we do. Twitter is the place to go, at Earth Eats.
Mark Chilla occupies this spot in our weekly show. Thanks.
You got it.
The U.S. Agriculture Department had a golden vision when it launched an ambitious plan a decade ago for a computer system meant to modernize how the government pays farmers and ranchers. Symbolizing that hope, the acronym for this huge project was MIDAS. But things went wrong with the program early on, and now, as Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe reports, the MIDAS program has lost that golden glow.
Up here in the cab of his combine, riding 10 feet above his soybean fields in northern Missouri, Blake Hurst is getting lots of information. To his right are three computer monitors, the largest with satellite maps showing a computerized aerial view of the tiny square of a John Deere slowly moving across the land, sucking up soybeans.
That is the yield monitor, and that map is showing the yields in the different parts of the field. And so the green is good.
Joystick in hand, reading from the monitors, Hurst knows how much fertilizer's been used, the bean's moisture content, and that he's getting 60 bushels an acre. Farming today is a high-tech business. All that information each farmer generates fuels government subsidies, programs that run the gamut from farm loans to conservation payments. Those payouts are done by the Farm Service Agency, operated by the USDA. Farm Service launched MIDAS to better connect farmers and ranchers with the government. Here's an early public service announcement.
MIDAS, or Modernize and Innovate the Delivery of Agricultural Systems, will increase Farm Service Agency efficiency and reduce redundancy.
Years into the project, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack was not so chipper about MIDAS, going biblical before a congressional panel in July.
In Proverbs, there's a couple of suggestions that a wise man measures his steps, and a wise man has many counselors. With reference to MIDAS, we didn't measure our steps, and we didn't have as many counselors as we needed, frankly.
After spending $430 million, MIDAS is now 2 years overdue and just 20% operational, according to government reports.
There were definitely red flags in 2011.
That's David Powner of the Government Accountability Office, a congressional watchdog. He's done three reports on MIDAS, the latest released this June.
So that was probably the biggest surprise. Not only did you have, you know, bad news on a schedule overrun, you were over budget by close to $100 million, but you still only then delivered 20% of the functionality that was planned.
What happened? The audits say there was failure to follow common practices, such as setting benchmarks, a lack of management, and problems with the private contractors. Farm Service representatives turned down several requests for comment, but Vilsack admitted during the July hearing that one of the problems came from Farm Service's IT hub in Kansas City.
We failed to recognize that there was a different vision in Kansas City where some of this work was going to be done and a different vision in D.C. And as a result of that conflict, things didn't get set up as they should have.
So how does this affect farmers? Well, most don't know about the MIDAS program, given that it's not working. Along with running his family business, Blake Hurst is president of the Missouri Farm Bureau. He was asked by congressional leaders to check the project and report back.
It's very, very frustrating.
As frustrating for the rest of us as if, say, we had to file our taxes by paper at a local IRS office. The current Farm Service system is so antiquated, Hurst says, that after he creates a report on his output, he hand-delivers his paperwork to two different government agencies in a nearby town.
Now I'm generating the same information three different times, and all the time I've got a thumb drive with all that information already on it.
What's next for MIDAS? Vilsack put the project on hold last summer and told Congress in July that he's established a weekly review process. But that means that high-tech harvest of information will not be coming from farmers' home computers or combines anytime soon. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
Later on, a look inside where some immigrant farm workers live, also with Harvest. It's a fast-paced world we live in, which is why these long holiday weekends can be so special. For those of us who spent most of Thanksgiving in the kitchen, we might want to do anything but cooking in the days that follow. Or maybe the cooking part of your brain kicked into gear, and that's exactly how you want to be spending these late November days. Well, today we present a snippet of a really special day of cooking in Columbus, Indiana. A day that was spent kneeling in front of the fireplace. Daniel Orr welcomed us into his friend Gretchen Marx's house. You'll hear her asking about the cheese ball in just a second. Daniel has some ducks, pumpkins, and chicken mushrooms that will all slow cook over the open fire. So pull up a seat next to the fireplace. There's some snacks there to enjoy.
cheese ball?
Yeah.
Okay.
I love it.
All right, so let's get these ducks going. If you want to, you can cook duck so it's kind of medium rare and pink inside, but we're going to do more of a traditional roast duck where we're going to let it get really nice and crispy and crunchy and have that great crisp skin.
That's the best part.
Yeah. But first, what we want to do is season our ducks, and I've got two small ducks from Maple Leaf Farm right here in Indiana, and I'm going to season them with some salt and pepper. And we're going to cut up a little bit of citrus to stick inside. And what that does is kind of helps cut the greasiness a little bit and gives you that nice perfume. So I'll put about a half a lemon in each one. And then we're going to add, of course, garlic, which is one of our favorite flavors. Okay, so we're just going to cut this garlic clove kind of east to west so you really expose all the openings of the garlic, and then we're going to put some rosemary and thyme inside.
Is this a case where you could season it however you like, or are these spices and these flavors especially great for duck?
Well, these do go really nice with duck. I mean, the rosemary has that kind of oily, piney aroma to it, which is really nice with the duck. And the richness and the fattiness of the duck will really pick up these flavors of citrus and the pininess of the rosemary. Thyme's another good one. And these herbs are also herbs that kind of last later into the fall and early winter outside. If you cover them up with some leaves from the garden, you can kind of keep them going almost through the new year.
Mm-hmm. And just over here, we have the organ meats from the duck cooking up in a pan.
Yeah, kind of spitting out of it. And these will be great in stuffing, or we can mix them in with a little bit of wild rice, which would be really tasty. You can use the necks for stock, but there's still actually a good amount of meat, and my mother loves to chew on these necks, so we'll probably just throw them right on the grill with the ducks.
Our fire was started by Daniel's mom, Mary Lou. She collected a batch of dried flowers and herbs that were devoured by the fire. You can still smell hints of oregano and sage in the air. We've let the fire calm down a bit.
You don't want a whole lot of flame. You don't want to cook over a high flame. And as you can see here, I've got this little pan that we're going to catch the drippings on. And I'm going to put the ducks towards the back because I don't want them just to drip on the fire and have a lot of flare up. So we're just going to start these guys. We'll start them on the breast side down. You know, this is not the quickest cooking method. So this is more of a, you know, day around the fireplace that you're, you know, cracking walnuts and chatting and eating cheeses, and the ducks slowly cook over the fire. So it's not something that you're going to rush. I would say probably about an hour and a half to 2 hours. The liver's going there. This we're going to let go a little bit quicker. I'm going to move these ducks just back a little bit. And every once in a while, I'm going to baste my ducks back here, and you can kind of see this wonderful collection of things going on. And throughout the day, we'll add a few more things. We've got these figs here we can put down in the drip pan as well. Maybe finish it off with a little bit of red wine and a little bit of butter for a sauce.
Talk to me about these pumpkins that look like, looking on the bottom, looks like they're really starting to cook.
Yeah, these are really starting to cook. They're getting soft. These are pumpkins I grew out by the road. They were volunteers from the compost heap. I'm going to let them slow cook. I'll cut them in half, scoop out the seeds, and then we can put a little bit of brown sugar and butter and maybe a squeeze of lemon juice and some salt and pepper, and they'll be great. And we can just kind of cut them up. They haven't been, you know, processed. A lot of times if you buy squash and things in the supermarket, they'll have been waxed or dipped in wax. These, we know, haven't been waxed. You can actually eat the skin and everything on these little guys.
While we wait, Daniel preps another snack.
Well, we've got some chicken of the woods mushrooms. These are, they really do have the taste and texture of chicken.
Mmm, you're right.
Aren't those delicious? What we do is we braise them. A lot of other mushrooms you wouldn't add this much liquid to, but these kind of slow cook, and they can tend to be a little bit dry, but when you cook them in a little bit of chicken stock or a little bit of vegetable stock, they absorb the moisture. You can finish it with a little bit of butter. And they have this really nice bright yellow bottom and kind of an orangey lobster shell colored top. And they keep in the refrigerator quite well for a week or two. So if you're lucky enough to find them, you can keep them around. You can also braise them off and freeze them and save them for Christmas time. So that's what I love to do, is to, you know, gather these things throughout the year. And then during December is the time to celebrate. And luckily, you know, I can cook pretty well, so people like to come visit.
So when did you find these?
These were found by a guy who works at FHB, the Firehouse Broadcasting, and he called me and said, what do I do with these mushrooms? So I told him, and he said, well, you know, it seems like a lot of work. Why don't you just have them? So I said, yeah, I'll take them.
It's so good to have friends.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Throughout the year, different people call me. They'll have a tree full of cherries, or a churchyard had a pear tree in it and nobody wanted the pears. So, you know, I was serving churchyard pears at the restaurant. So a lot of fun. Mm. One more for you?
Yes, please.
It's hot.
Gosh, it's good. How's the duck?
The duck's coming right along. You can smell it. It's. I've turned them over. They're starting to get nice brown on the breast side. We're going to start crisping up the back skin, and then we will finish them off on the breast side one more time to really get that nice crunchy skin. Yeah, so they've probably got about another hour to go.
Over that day, Daniel made some eggnog and a goat cheese ball, some parsnip soup as well. The duck was just magnificent, and so were the pumpkins. Our website can be your one-stop shop for recipes this holiday season, and you don't want to miss out on the pictures, so get on over to eartheats.org. Just ahead, Brad Dunn is a Scotch man, from light and citrusy.
And you go all, you can run all the way through to ones that are, have more brown sugar, that are almost more bourbon-like.
And then some are very smoky. We geek out with him coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. It is the holiday season, a perfect excuse to dust off those forgotten bottles of wine and bring them to your friends' houses and then conveniently leave them behind. Well, this year, Brad Dunn suggests you learn about whiskey. Brad says there are so many more options beside the big labels.
Craft distilling is really coming up behind this wave of craft brewing.
Dunn is the sommelier and beverage director at the Uptown Cafe.
It's a little more difficult to open up, you know, a craft distillery, the laws, first of all, and obviously it's legal to brew beer at home, whereas I'm sure you may or may not know, it's not legal to distill, hence the caricature of moonshining.
In this part of the country, we might then think about bourbon.
I think the most important thing to understand about bourbon is that it's based on an age-old recipe. And it has to do with the percentage of corn. So bourbon is made from a mash bill, which is essentially the recipe, essentially, that is 51% or more corn. Another huge misconception about bourbon, that bourbon is from Kentucky, with good reason, because Kentucky is sort of the one of the most associated. It's like the Napa Valley of bourbon, you could say. But bourbon can be from anywhere within the United States.
Similarly, Scotch is produced in Scotland. There are all these rules that dictate what makes Scotch Scotch. It's outlined in the Scotch Whiskey Regulations of 2009. It must be distilled in Scotland and matured in oak casks in Scotland for at least 3 years.
Most Scotch that we buy is at these big houses like Black Label and Chivas and all that are blends. They're blends of maybe 20 up to maybe 50 different Scotches, which are great. Blends are great. But if you want to just put 2 minutes of thought into it, try and find a single malt.
That means the Scotch has been distilled with malted barley, and only barley. The grain is soaked in water for 2 to 3 days, allowing it to germinate and produce the enzymes needed to process starch into fermentable sugars. And then single means that the malt comes from only one distillery, unlike blended Scotches. Single malts give the Scotch lover more to latch onto in terms of depth and variety of flavor.
So if you get a Scotch that's, you know, light and maybe citrusy, you know, it's a more delicate Scotch, it's really nice on the rocks with a twist, and you go all, you can run all the way through to ones that are, have more brown sugar, that are almost more bourbon-like. And then you go over, you know, a little bit west into the Islay Scotches, and some, you know, some of them, you know, it's like drinking a campfire. If you, you know, any of my buddies that are out there, if you can't think of what to get me, Scotch.
There's Brad Dunn's holiday gift request. He's also talked about wine and champagne and mezcals on Earth Eats. From our website, just search Brad Dunn and see what pops up.
Well, down in New Orleans, where everything's fine. Oh, and catfish drinking that wine.
The migrant workers who pick crops like cotton and melons in the U.S. can have a tough time finding a place to live. The rural areas where they find work often lack social services and affordable housing. That means many farm worker families end up in dilapidated buildings, which can come with health risks. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted has the story.
I'm driving Angel Castro down a muddy road covered with flooded potholes. He's showing me the neighborhood he lived in during the 90s. It sits just behind a large John Deere store in rural southeast Missouri.
This is one of the trailer parks that that rent to migrant people. And it's not in the greatest shape, you know.
Dozens of trailers and campers sit on lots littered with plastic bottles and food wrappers. Large tires hold down roofs. Siding is falling off the mobile homes, and cracked windows are covered up with plastic. Castro says during growing season, these trailers pack in up to 10 farm workers.
It depends on how many people are staying in the trailer. You know, it's like, I think it's like $120 a month or something, a person.
Castro was born in Mexico but raised in Texas. His family spent summers chasing the watermelon crop from state to state as migrant farm workers. Now he has a job recruiting farm workers' kids to enroll in school programs. Almost three-quarters of hired crop farm workers don't actually travel the country following the harvest, according to Department of Agriculture data. Rather than short-term migrants looking for seasonal work, many farm workers are looking for a place to settle.
You know, when we used to travel, you know, we ran in some of those trailers too, you know. And I remember my sister used to cry, you know. I said, look at the places where we live. My dad said, it's only a month. Just write it out a month and we'll be out of here.
Generally, there are three types of housing options for farm workers. Private housing, like the trailers Castro lived in, employee housing provided by a boss, and government-funded housing.
There is a big need across the country, and so there's probably more need than money that we have.
U.S. Rural Housing Administrator Tony Hernandez lends money through a federal program to build farm worker housing.
This is a really effort to make sure people have safe and decent housing and better working conditions, and housing's a major part of that.
Virginia Ruiz is the director of occupational and environmental health of the advocacy group Farmworker Justice. She says farmworkers are often priced out of rural rental markets that lack the resources, infrastructure, or desire to build affordable housing. That can lead to cramped conditions.
It's very stressful. It's easier in overcrowded housing for contagious diseases to spread.
Tuberculosis, pesticide exposure, and viral breakouts are a few of the more common threats facing farm workers living in housing without adequate showers, ventilation, and utilities. Incidents have popped up in rural Iowa and Illinois.
Practically every state has a lack of enforcement.
Moises Losa is the executive director of the Housing Assistance Council. His group works to improve housing conditions in rural areas. He says enforcement on housing codes doesn't happen often enough because of limited resources. And you're not going to hear the tenants raising a fuss about the conditions either. Why?
First of all, they're uninformed about what rights they might have or what codes there are in housing. But even if they did know, they're also afraid of, you know, getting the immigration after them.
None of the residents we spoke to would consent to be recorded. In southeast Missouri, Angel Castro says the trailer park is filling up with farm workers from Central America without options.
You know, when you don't have the money or the means to get somewhere else, you know, buy somewhere else, you know, you have to do what you have to survive, to live.
He says without education or enforcement of housing codes, the living conditions for the tenants who continue to work the fields will linger. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
That story was reported as part of a fellowship with the Institute for Justice and Journalism. Daniel Orr once more today with what he's calling a gourmet cheese whiz.
All right, today we're going to make a typical old English appetizer, and it's called Welsh rarebit. It's not rabbit, so don't worry about it. If you're a bunny lover, we don't kill any bunnies for this. But we do have some nice dark ale, about a cup of that. We're just going to put that in a saucepan. And then we're going to take an ounce of butter, add that. We're going to melt 3 cups of nice farmhouse cheddar. We're going to season that with some mustard. That's one of the key ingredients. So we got some powdered mustard. Gives it a lot of good flavor. Pinch of salt. I'm going to turn the heat down, and we're going to stir that until the cheese melts. It's going to be kind of like a fondue. Just give that a little taste. Man, I could use a beer now. And this is a lot of cheese, but this would be for a group. If you're going to have 10 or 12 people over for drinks, it'd be great to serve during a ball game. And then if there are any leftovers, just put it inside your omelet the next morning. We're just going to serve it with some bread. I've got some biscuit biscotti, which are some twice-baked savory biscuits that you can dip into this. A lot of times the English will serve some pickles alongside as well. And there we go. That's our Welsh rarebit with biscuit biscotti.
The most traditional way to serve this is to pour it on top of a thick slice of bread and put it under a broiler. That's how you get a really fancy, open-faced grilled cheese sandwich type thing. That recipe and a photo at eartheats.org. Our team of producers, writers, and webmasters includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Kate Griebel, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, Kale Wilk, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. All the best from us here at Earth Eats. See you next week. I'm Annie Corrigan.